The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Kate Andrews. We've just had the spending review from the Chancellor and we're going to get on to the main measures. But before we do, I think there was a sense in the build-up to Rishi Sunak's statement that one of the big stories from the announcement of the spending review is not going to be any specific measure the Chancellor is announcing so much as the snapshot of the state of the UK economy that we got from the OBR. Kate, can you fill us in?
Alongside the Chancellor's spending review today, we got updated economic forecasts and scenarios published by the Office for Budget Responsibility. And look, anybody who's been living through these lockdowns, fire breakers, circuit breakers, know that the economy has been completely devastated by coronavirus and the measures that we've needed to take to tackle it. But the data published today just makes that so abundantly clear. The UK economy is now set to shrink by 11.3% this year. That is the largest economic fall in 300 years. And perhaps even more painfully, the road to recovery is forecast to be a relatively long one. We're not expected to return to pre-COVID levels for another 2 years. That's Q4 of 2022. If you look at the shape, the trajectory of the recovery, there is no sharp V. We have another contraction at the end of this year. And then it's a pretty lackluster recovery for several years. And that, you know, in simple terms, that means a poor, less wealthy nation for quite some time. We've now had a downgrade in the prediction of the size of the economy in 2025 to be 3% smaller than the March budget predicted. And along with all of this, you have debt that's now going to hover around 100% of GDP. We're in a deeply vulnerable state. Interest rates are at an ultra low, but if they are to budge, if they're to move, the UK could be looking at having to spend tens of billions of pounds on financing its debt alone. These are very troubling economic times, and the Office for Budget Responsibility has highlighted what I think a lot of us knew, but these updates are still grim when you get them.
And we just heard about the backdrop to all this and some of the gloomy forecasts to come, James. So what was the Chancellor's main message from the spending review? Was it aimed more at getting us through the next few months, or do we get a few hints of the longer term strategy in terms of getting us out of this hole?
So the UK is going to borrow £394 billion this year. It's going to be borrowing over £100 billion every year in this parliament. And I think what Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, was trying to say is, look, we can spend this money now because the fiscal position going into this crisis was not too bad, but this is not sustainable. And it is quite clear from some small moves he made today that he wants to put the public finances onto a more sustainable footing. So we had this announcement that, you know, any public sector worker paid over £24,000 will have their pay frozen as a kind of economy measure. You're also going to see aid spending, he proposed, fall from 0.7% to 0.5%. And I think these are indications that he is trying to say to people that there are going to have to be tough choices made to get the books back into balance, and that the spending this year has been exceptional. I thought there was an amazing moment when he was setting out how much would be spent on the COVID response in the next financial year. And you were £55 billion next year dealing with COVID. That is a remarkable sign. And I think the question we've got now is, I think we now, for the first time since Boris Johnson told people back in March to, you know, gave them that instruction to stay at home, I think we can say how this crisis ends. It's quite clear that by April, I think the vaccine will basically mean the social distancing measures will fall away. And I think we can expect a fairly strong economic rebound at that point. Look at the fact the economy grew 15.5% after the first lockdown, even though, you know, every business had kind of one side on the side of a swimming pool because they knew that restrictions could come back. But I think the damage done to the public finances by this is really quite immense. And the question then becomes, you know, how do you do this fiscal consolidation? Austerity is much harder now, I think, for two reasons. The first is all the low-hanging fruit was essentially picked by George Osborne. And secondly, the new coalition of voters that the Tories have, they didn't vote for austerity. They voted for levelling up, something that costs money. And so how are you going to do this fiscal consolidation is, I think, the really big question.
And Kate, when it comes to difficult decisions, as some like to call it, including the Chancellor, we did get a hint of a few which we are going to see more immediately before we even get to potentially future tax rises. So one was the public sector pay freeze. Can you talk us through the justification put forward by the government on this? Because as James touched on, if you think about that coalition of voters and the message, what feels like more than a year ago, but around a year ago from Boris Johnson about a higher spend pitch, I think people would not have expected a pandemic, but the burden going on public sector workers, I suppose.
Well, it's ironic, isn't it? Because in terms of that higher spend pitch, they've definitely delivered. We have spent, as James says, close to £400 billion this year, but it will be close to £400 billion this year. But now we are looking at those difficult decisions. And to your question, Katie, about the pay freeze, the Chancellor made very clear today that those in the private sector are much more vulnerable to redundancies. And actually, the data that we already have shows that they, on average, are taking a pay cut, where the public sector so far has had a pay increase. So he just doesn't think it's fair in this very difficult time to continue to dish out those pay raises to those who are more likely to keep their jobs in the first place, and to then ask the taxpayer, many of whom are in the private sector, to pay for that. I find it remarkable, however, that there's been so much pushback on this reduction in foreign aid contributions and on this public sector pay freeze, which, by the way, has only been announced for 2021. In theory, it could be picked up in the following years. If this is already upsetting people, I don't think there's any real understanding of what is about to come. As James laid out, these public finances are in an absolute state, and the Chancellor actually failed to make a lot of the difficult decisions today. Now, you can argue that's perfectly reasonable. Many things could change. We're now hopeful about the way out of this virus. We hope that next year, the vast majority of the population will be inoculated, but many more barriers could be put up before we get there. The government doesn't know how much money really still it's going to have to spend, so you wait to make those longer term announcements. But, the Chancellor just scratched the surface today of some of those difficult trade-offs that he's going to have to consider to get the public finances back on track. And the fact that people are already so up in arms shows me that there's no understanding of how the situation, or very limited, let's say, understanding of how the situation's changed between 6 months ago and now. The promises that any party made in its manifesto are more or less going to have to be reconsidered now, considering the circumstances that we find ourselves in.
At the risk of turning myself into Kate's kind of amen corner here, I think one of the challenges here is one of the things that this pandemic shows is that rainy days happen. When George Osborne said, we've got to repair the public finances for when the next crisis hits, everyone's like, oh, come on, these things don't come along that often. We've had the 2008 financial crisis. We've had this pandemic. There are, I think, structural reasons to think why pandemics might become a more common thing in future. I can see Katie grimacing at me at that thought. It would be deeply irresponsible to say, we can just kind of leave the finances as they are. And if I want to add a properly depressing note of this, one of the things that people often say is, go for growth. That's the way. And obviously, growth would help. But one of the things that would happen, I think, with growth, if you did get a kind of revival in growth, which is a possibility, kind of not just in the UK, but in the broader Western economy, if capital had more productive places to go, it would be less keen to borrow, to lend money very cheaply to the government. So the cost of government borrowing in a higher growth environment would likely go up. So I think this is why kind of sorting out the public finances is a necessity. And over £100 billion a year in borrowing, this is serious money here. This is not some small deficit.
Now, on that gloomy note, Kate, let's go to the second, I think, probably, if we're talking about the most controversial measures in the spending review, and that's on international aid. There is a reduction. Can you talk us through it?
So the Chancellor has reduced the contribution that the UK will be paying from 0.7% down to 0.5%, and that accounts for roughly £4 billion that won't be spent on foreign aid contribution next year. He said that he would like to get it back to 0.7%, and I think there are going to be some legal questions about the extent to which the government can just unilaterally make these decisions. It's certainly a breach of what the Tory party was promising in its manifesto. And look, that £4 billion isn't going to go terribly far, but it strikes me as more symbolic, although no doubt those who are very upset to see it go will argue that that money could be wisely used to help those in developing countries, especially on the health front. But it does symbolize the fact that more is going to come in terms of cuts, and that savings are going to have to be found. And, you know, these cuts were announced alongside spending increases. Day-to-day spending next year is set to increase by £14.8 billion in cash terms. It's the fastest rise in 15 years. So it isn't as if today was just about slashing. We also got a lot of news about new spending commitments, including a £4 billion levelling up pot that people will be able to apply to for more infrastructure. And I guess it goes back to that point that nobody wants to recognise that something's got to give. And we can have a debate about whether or not it should be the foreign aid budget, much of which is spent quite productively, not all of it, but a lot of it. But, you know, if you're not going to cut the foreign aid budget, what are you going to cut? And the sense today is that nobody wants to say, because these are painful decisions, and arguably the Chancellor didn't even want to say. I mean, he really defended both of the difficult decisions he made on public sector pay and the foreign aid contributions today, but he didn't want to go much further. Eventually, he's probably going to have to, but nobody's putting forward what they would cut instead of the foreign aid budget. People are just saying they don't want cuts at all.
And there are plenty of people saying they don't like the foreign aid cut, James. We've had former prime ministers, but I suppose perhaps more worrying, at least in the near future way for the government, is the number of sitting MPs who don't like it. Now, can you talk us through this in the sense, aid doesn't need to go to a vote because it's already in law, because I think with the current 0.7, there's a tiny little bit of space if there's exceptional circumstances for not meeting it. So is this going to have to go to a vote of MPs? And secondly, if it does, how's it looking? Because we know the One Nation caucus are pretty anti it, whereas there are some MPs in terms of red wall intake who've come out and been a lot more supportive of it.
So I think it likely will have to go to a vote, because I think the general view is that the bill was if you couldn't meet it, but you were planning to meet it. Well, is this obviously different because the government is budgeting on the assumption that it will not meet it. There is definitely opposition to the Tory party. You had Andrew Mitchell say that, you know, any MP who voted for it wouldn't be able to look their children in the eye because, you know, they would have led to 100,000 preventable deaths, which is a slightly odd argument. In essentially, that's like you could say that anyone not voting to increase the foreign aid budget to 0.9% would be responsible for how many deaths. I mean, it slightly loses you at that point. You also had Tobias Elwood, Pauline Latham, Jeremy Hunt all expressing concerns.
You've had a resignation.
Baroness Sugg, who used to work for David Cameron, has now resigned, I think, showing how strongly the Cameroon wing of the Tory party feel about this. I think there is a certain irony about this, though, which is this is coming in the same week that this country has announced a scientific breakthrough that will do more to help the developing world recover from coronavirus than anything else. This Oxford vaccine that will be retailed at £3 a shot, that only needs to be kept at fridge temperature, removing all of the cold chain storage issues. I do think there is something slightly odd about the kind of self-flagellation about this cut in the aid budget in response to what are exceptionally dire public finance situation. Yet at the same week, you know, this country has done something that is going to make a massive difference to the developing world because of the price of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine and the storage issues. You know, and it isn't an accident that this happened. Oxford said about the brilliant scientists at Oxford said about inventing a vaccine that you know didn't have these cold chain storage issues. And secondly, the UK and Oxford University kind of said about using the IP to find a company that they could develop it with, who were prepared in the immediate height of this pandemic to sell it on a not-for-profit basis. That is a huge contribution to the welfare of the developing world.
Now, finally, we've had the spending review, which has clearly dominated the news today. But yesterday, we were given an announcement of the government's Christmas plan in terms of the Christmas amnesty, which you might call it, which is a The 23rd to the 27th, people can form a Christmas bubble of up to 3 households. Though I think the emphasis on what you should and shouldn't do might depend on which part of the UK you are in. Tomorrow, we're expecting to find out, I suppose, the bad news bit of this, which is the government has announced a relaxation of rules around Christmas. But part of the bargain there is that we are heading into a stricter three-tier system when lockdown ends. And tomorrow, Thursday, is going to be when you find out which areas go into which tier. Kate, the general sense seems to be we're not going to see the number one very much, isn't it? It's more of a 2-3 land we're going to live in.
Well, the Daily Mail suggests that no region in England may even be put into tier one, which means that the lowest level we could be expecting in England is tier two. And that's a big crackdown on socializing indoors. And from a business perspective, this is going to be very difficult. UK Hospitality did a survey when the tiers were looser before lockdown and found that over 75% of pubs didn't think that they would be able to last the year under the current restrictions at the time. And those have now tightened, especially if you're in tier three, you're only going to be able to offer takeaway services. And for this to be happening around Christmas is even more painful. Yes, non-essential retail is going to be allowed to open in all the tiers, but pubs, restaurants, shops, they'll have lost a lot of business in these weeks, these crucial weeks, the weeks that many businesses rely on to be viable leading up to Christmas Day. And I think there's still some outstanding questions about how viable this tier system is if we indeed are to live with it for months. The Prime Minister has suggested that we're going to be in the tier system until spring at the earliest. And there's still some inconsistencies. You still have curfews, which we know don't have scientific backing of SAGE. There's still some pretty outstanding questions about the lack of socializing even outdoors. Outdoor events are going to be able to have thousands of spectators, but we're still not going to legally be able to meet 7 people in a private garden, even socially distanced. So it's going to be hard to sustain. If you're moved into tier three, some of the criteria has been set out as to how you might come down the tier levels, but it's never been specific. We have never known exactly what criteria you need to meet to go in and out or up and down the tier system. And I think those questions are going to grow louder because it is looking like it's going to be a very difficult winter. Yes, Christmas is this little moment of amnesty, as you say, Katie, but it's brief. And then we get into those very cold, long winter months and people grow restless.
Finally, James, how much of a row do you think we're going to see tomorrow when the tiers are announced in the Commons?
I think if Jason Grove's scoop in the mail but nowhere is in tier one is true, I think you will see a row. I think there'll be Tory MPs from the areas of lower infections will be very unhappy about that. I also think that anywhere placed in tier three is going to be very unhappy as well. I mean, that's going to be difficult. I have to admit, on Christmas, I have a slightly...
I didn't realize we had a Scrooge on the podcast. But
no, I have a slightly nervous feeling about this, which is I personally think it would have been better to relax it. I mean, look, I think you had to have some relaxation at Christmas. Otherwise, reasonable people were going to feel that they couldn't follow the rules, which would obviously be problematic. But I have to admit, I have a kind of sense it might have been better to relax it within a small geographical area. So you could have, say, 10 people around your table, but they had to have come from within 10 miles or so. I think one of the dangers is that you have people going from high infection areas to low infection areas. And if you look at the Canadian experience with Thanksgiving, they have their Thanksgiving earlier than the Americans do. There are some signs there that the travel associated with Thanksgiving appears to have led to a rise in COVID cases there. I think that is the concern. And my other worry about it is one of the reasons these tiers are going to be so tight when they're announced on Thursday is to try and keep the virus under control before Christmas. And one of the things I worry about is that as we all are in tier three in January, that you basically will see that the kind of consequence of the Christmas relaxation is that as soon as it's over, there'll be a kind of further tightening of the restriction screw. And I had a rare moment today when I felt a certain sympathy of Nicola Sturgeon when she said, look, Easter next year should be on. So maybe we should all be kind of thinking about Easter as the kind of, you know, maybe we should all make a kind of decision that we'll all get together with our families at Easter and have our big celebration then. But I can tell that from the reaction of the room that I'm definitely not carrying the room with me on this one.
Well, there's some food for thought. Thank you, James. Thank you, Kate. And thank you for listening.